Blog Talk Radio.
From deepest, darkest Africa, across the polar ice cap, spanning the jungles of South America, without a compass, without a map, Blog Talk Radio and Wildlife Educational Services presents Larry Batson's Wild World. Discover the wonders of the natural world with nationally known wildlife educator Larry Batson as we visit his wild world.
Well, hello everyone from the remote jungles of Clinton Falls, Indiana. This is Larry Batson, and you are listening to Wild World on this magical network we call Blog Talk Radio as we reach around the world. Hello to our listeners in Australia, New Zealand, Ireland, England, and even the small community of Monrovia, Indiana. It's great to have you along. We have an outstanding show planned tonight. Returning once again, we call him America's greatest sports fan. Mark Chesnin will be joining us all the way from the fine state of West Virginia. And it's quite a thrill tonight because we have with us, I believe, one of the premier broadcasters, a wonderful show called The One-on-One. They call it the fastest hour in radio. Mark Monteith will be with us. In fact, he's part of the Pacers broadcasting team, so we'll have a chance to talk a little bit about basketball, Pacers, Racers, and whatever may be included in this hour. And as always, from the Wild World News Studios, now HD, newly renovated, the honorable, distinguished, and always regular, Dr. Henry Day. Good evening, Doctor.
We hope. Good evening, Mr. Batson.
We do. It's rather balmy out tonight.
Oh, yes, it is. It's about 80% humidity, 73 degrees here in Naptown tonight.
I think it's pretty close to that here at the compound.
About 10 o'clock.
Yeah, the alligators are thinking they're back in the Everglades.
Well, but good for them.
I'm not complaining because I remember January and February, and so do they, so it's all good.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. The whole year was just kind of nasty for us, and hopefully it'll calm down here a little bit.
Yeah, we hope so.
The hummingbirds are back, aren't they?
Oh, the hummingbirds are back. In fact, we had visitors today. They're busy right now, Dr. Day, as you know, on the nest. So.
Nesting season, yes it is.
But we'll get inundated here within the next few days, and there'll be, I don't know, we've got two feeders out here in Putnam County. We'll have 50 hummingbirds at them before we know it, so
yeah,
we've got
that to
look forward to.
Yeah, there's quite a few here, and I've watched them the last few days unwrapping spider webs. They use spider webs for their nests, and I've watched them unwrap them from my pine tree out front.
Really? Boy, just think about that. What engineer the hummingbird is.
Yeah.
Man alive. This part of Wild World is brought to you by Chautauqua Lake Bigfoot Weekend and Expo. It's all on video, 6 hours video on demand. Go to their website, ChautauquaLakeBigfoot.com. If you're a fan of the Discovery Channel shows, Finding Bigfoot, In Search of Sasquatch, all that stuff. It's all there featuring the infamous Bob Gimlin. Go to the website, ChautauquaLakeBigfoot.com. Video on demand, 6 hours of video for only $4.99. What a deal.
It's a must.
It is a must. And they make it possible for Wild World to be on Blog Talk Radio.
It's now time from his broadcasting mecca in Indianapolis, Indiana, the distinguished Dr. Henry Day with the Wild World News.
Good evening. This is Dr. Henry Day with the Wild World News for May 29th. Well, it turns out that exercise is good.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, after scientists set up little exercise wheels in the great outdoors, wild animals from mice to rats to frogs gave the workout equipment a spin. Yes, believe it or not.
Oh, my.
Yeah, with no personal trainer in sight. Now, what the scientists did was they set up these little wheels similar to the ones used by caged hamsters and other pets.
Mm-hmm.
And even slugs tried out the wheels, even though they're not sure that they clearly succeeded in raising their heart rates.
I wonder what million-dollar grant paid for that.
Yeah. Now, here's what they did. They set up video cameras in a seaside nature preserve.
Yeah.
And for part of the experiment, the researchers left dishes of mouse chow and bits of chocolate near the wheels allowing the animals to come in and eat and then to, you know, binge and then run off the calories.
Wow.
Yeah. Now, the animals ran on the wheels whether there were treats there or not. Now, nearly 90% of the exercise sessions were by mice, but there were also rats, shrews, frogs, slugs, and lots of other little crawly creatures you'd normally find on the ground. And what they decided was that the study shows the wheel is clearly pleasurable. Yeah.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
That may be one of the dumbest stories you've come up
with, Dr.
Daniel.
Millions of dollars spent on exercise wheels for rodents.
Yeah,
but
okay.
They say that the wheels are clearly pleasurable. So.
Yeah, okay.
And maybe we need big ones for us.
There you go.
All right, well, we've got a new Terrapin Theater in Navarre Beach, Florida. Construction on a saltwater pool at the Navarre Beach Sea Turtle Conservation Center will be completed by tomorrow.
Oh,
and
what
does that mean? Well, they're rehabbing a bunch of sea turtles, and they're building a stadium next to the recovery center where you can actually sit and watch the turtles rehab.
Well, I bet that'll be very popular.
It will be, yes.
Yeah.
And
people love turtles. Yeah, they do love their turtles.
All right, now we've got a red tide, dead tide, Seabrooks, Texas. Hundreds of thousands of dead fish have littered the Galveston Bay shoreline area after an oxygen-depleting red tide moved in. And what will happen is it will kind of close off a little inlet area and take all the oxygen out of the water, and you've got thousands of dead fish.
Yeah.
I've witnessed it myself a few times in Tampa when I lived in Tampa.
Yeah, it's not pretty. Yeah, I'll bet.
Yeah, it just smells like low tide all the time.
Oh.
Not that there's anything wrong with that.
Well, yeah, absolutely.
All right, our next story takes us to Ohio, and I wanted to do a shout-out since we're in Ohio to Melissa Hovey and Wayne Larson.
Yeah.
They're good friends of ours, and we know they're listening.
Yes, they are.
All right, Toledo, Ohio. Crews from the State Department of Natural Resources Division of Wildlife today released two falcon chicks out of their nest atop the University Hall on the University of Toledo campus. Yes, two little falcon chicks. Now, each chick will get a leg ID, a little band on their leg, so that they can track it after it leaves the nest, after they kicked it out of the nest.
That's cool.
Yep. Well, that goes on all the time, and it's just to kind of give us an idea. Now, one time I was in southern Indiana throwing rocks, and I knocked a bat out of the air. How's that possible? I don't know. But anyway, it had an IU band on it, so I called the IU University and said I accidentally killed one of your bats, and here's the number. They said, we don't care, so I hung up.
Is that a true story?
Yep.
Oh, good.
No. All right, signs everywhere, signs. Salina, Ohio. Yes, it's happening everywhere. A toxic blue-green algae is making swimming hazardous at the Grand Lake St. Mary's. And warning signs are going up along the beaches. So if you've never swum in the toxic blue-green algae, when you come out of the water, you will be a different color.
Yuck.
And very itchy.
Oh, my.
All right, we got some really big news out of Greenville, South Carolina. Now,
good.
Joy, the Greenville Zoo's last remaining elephant is moving to a new home at Cheyenne Mountain Zoo in Colorado. Now, why are they doing this? Well, she's gotten up there in age, and she'll live with four other female African elephants in the exhibit that was designed for aging animals.
Hmm. That's a nice zoo.
Yeah.
It's a nice zoo. It's a nice facility, so good for them.
And why we're talking pachyderms? The District of Columbia. Now, the National Zoo's three new elephants are en route to their new home after leaving Calgary Zoo in Canada on two flatbed trucks. That's the way to travel.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, now the trio will boost the size of the Zeus herd to 7. Yeah, that's the way I like to travel on a flatbed.
Yeah, that's the way to vacation.
All right, we're not too proud of you at all in Santa Rosa Island, Florida. Land-based shark angler Ernie Polk and two buddies beached a whopper of a shark. A 13-foot, 6-inch great hammerhead, estimated to be about 1,450 pounds. Hammerhead shark, please.
Yeah. They, you know, and those are noted to be man-eaters, too.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. In fact, there's a beach down by Bradenton. It's pretty popular. It's also one of the highest populations of hammerhead sharks in the Atlantic.
I would guess that Tampa Bay is probably the greatest nursery for hammerheads.
Or Gulf of Mexico, I really should say.
Yeah, it
is.
I used to fish there quite often, and I never fished in Tampa Bay without catching a hammerhead.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
That's how plentiful they are.
Man.
But we're not proud of you guys for dragging that big boy onto the beach.
No, they should have just cut the line and let it go.
Yep, as soon as they realized what it was.
Absolutely.
All right, now we're heading off to Nome, Alaska.
Good.
Why? Well, musk oxen. You like musk oxen, don't you?
Yeah, we better be sure to take our mosquito repellent with us, though.
That's right.
They're about a pound a piece up there.
Yep, and as we reported last year, this time of the year, they ran out of mosquito repellent. And they were asking all friends and family members across the states to send them mosquito repellent because the mosquitoes were so bad.
I had friends that went on a fishing trip up there, and there was only one type of mosquito repellent that worked, and there was only one bottle and one guy that had it. And the other guys that were there with him offered him $1,000 for that bottle of mosquito repellent.
You see, there's a new job for us. We'll just get us a semi-double-clutching tractor trailer truckload full of mosquito repellent.
Well, you know, there's a fellow that I knew. Yeah, there's a guy that I knew used to go to Florida and load his semi with watermelons and haul them up to Alaska and sell every watermelon for like $20, $25 a piece. And then he'd sell the rig up there, and that's all he did once a year. Now, that's a job, I'm telling you.
Yeah, and a great drive, but if you like watermelon.
Yeah, I guess so.
All right, Nome, Alaska. A state biologist said getting too close to a musk oxen endangers their young calves.
It does.
And yourself, yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, now an early spring is moving the Seward Peninsula musk oxen closer to where people live. So the Alaska Fish and Game biologists say, leave them alone, don't get too close, because you'll scare the babies and you're also liable to be trampled.
That's pretty much like getting chased by a hairy Ford Torino. You know, those things are big.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Yeah.
And there's nothing that smells quite like a musk ox.
And you will not outrun them.
Nope.
Okay.
All right. To you two goons who shot the loons in Dover, New Hampshire, the New Hampshire Fish and Game officials know who you are, so it'd be best just to give yourself up now and save yourself a little bit of trouble. Don't make them come and get you.
That's right.
Now they're getting climbed in Neenah, Wisconsin. Swarms of lake flies are invading the Lake Winnebago area.
Oh,
yeah,
I've been there.
Now clinging to everything in sight and leaving behind a green mess when squashed.
Oh, my.
Yeah, now lake flies, they typically emerge around Mother's Day, but this year's batch was delayed by the cool spring weather.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've never dealt with these basically mayflies, it's not pretty.
We used to have them up at Lake Schaefer, and it was, my goodness. Fish loved them.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, the fish, it's a feeding frenzy for fish, but it's miserable for people.
Oh, yeah, it's a good fishing time. And while we're on fish, the old Farmer's Almanac says the next 2 weeks are the best for fishing.
Oh, I'll remember that.
Get out
drown a worm. Yep.
Now, in other news, South Charleston, West Virginia, officials said no fatalities or injuries were reported during the spring turkey hunting season in West Virginia for the first time since it was established in the late 1960s.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, the turkeys hunting turkeys, I mean.
Yeah, well, all I have to say is that's too bad. All right. I'm sorry about that. All right.
Well,
we're heading off to God's country here before too long. And you know what the big thing is in Colorado right now?
Legalization of marijuana.
Well, that's pretty popular, too. But the Colorado rafting companies are kicking into high gear as the heavy snowpack in the mountains begins to melt.
Oh, I'll bet they
are. Yeah, if you want to ride the white water, it's time to go.
Let's go. Leave in the morning.
All right, well, let's finish up the Wild World News tonight with the fact of the day.
Okay.
Hold on,
I'll sit down. Okay,
sit down.
I'm down.
A blue whale's aorta, which we know is the main blood vessel, is large enough for a human to crawl through.
Really?
If you ever have the desire to do that.
My God.
All right, I've done enough damage for the night. That's the Wild World News for May 29th.
Well, once again, a great job done by Dr. Henry Day and his staff at the Wild World News headquarters in Indianapolis, Indiana, now HD, newly renovated. In fact, they have a beautiful paneling on the walls. Isn't that true, Dr. Day?
Yes, it's Knotty Pine.
Knotty Pine. And we appreciate the work that they put in each week for their broadcast. We also want to encourage everyone to check out my website, LarryTheAnimalGuy.com. Tells all about our wildlife rescue work that we do. Also, our wildlife education programs. And we have a Facebook page that I think you'll enjoy, filled with videos and pictures and information. Larry the Animal Guy and Friends. It makes it possible for Wild World to be on Blog Talk Radio.
Round, round, get around, I get around, yeah, get around, round, round, I get around, I get around, get around, round, round.
Our guest tonight, all the way from the fine state of West Virginia, we call him America's greatest sports fan, Mark Chesnut, employed by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and along to the night's broadcast, what I consider one of the premier broadcasters here in Indiana, maybe all across the United States. Wonderful program, one-on-one, the fastest hour in radio. Mark Monteith joins us. And gentlemen, welcome to the program.
Nice to be here.
Thanks, Larry. Hey, I got a quick story to tell you about those lake flies he was talking about.
Oh.
I grew up in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, which is about 12 miles south of Neenah. And those lake flies that were on Lake Winnebago, many years ago, maybe 30 years ago, some brilliant scientist got the idea of doing a test with those lake flies. So he took them to Lake Butamore, which is a lake that kind of adjoins Lake Winnebago by the Fox River. And he wanted to see if these lake flies would grow also there. And so what they did is he took some over there. I don't know how he did it, what he did, but he planted them on that lake as well. And all of a sudden, now every year when this lake flies come up around Lake Winnebago in Oshkosh, Neenah, Appleton area, they also grow up on the Lake Butamore side of things, which has made everybody on the Lake Butamore side forever mad at the guy who tried to do that experiment years ago. So now those lake flies not only take the west side of Oshkosh and Neenah, but they take the east side, they take the west side because they also are now part of Lake Butamore on a regular basis. Coming from Oshkosh, I just had to throw that in.
Well, we're glad you did. I assume that person doesn't go to that area during that time.
No, that was years ago. I was still living there, I was in college back in 75, and it was before that. I grew up in Oshkosh, so it was probably in the early 70s, maybe even late 60s that it was that long ago that it happened. But I was surprised when I heard the doctor talk about the lake flies because that just brought me memories of home. So.
Yeah, well, all of the wildlife there are happy about the flies, even though the residents might not be.
Oh, no, and they cake your house. I mean, your house is caked with lake flies, and they just, they only last, a few days or a few weeks, but, I mean, a few days each, and they're gone. But they are a problem while they're there. But, yeah, it's...
We need pictures. We need pictures and video.
Yeah, I've been slimed.
Well, Mark Monteith, and I'll have to use the last names because we have double marks tonight. I mentioned this to you earlier. that Mr. Chesna, our other guest tonight, had the opportunity for the very first time, and he's been to over 2,800 sporting events, to come to our Indianapolis 500. And did he or did he not select one of the best races that we've ever had in the history of the track?
I think he got pretty gosh darn close.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, without a doubt, it was one of the great races of all times. And the largest number of attendance for any sporting event ever.
Yeah. What do you think, Mark Monteith?
Oh, the 500 is fantastic. You know, I did not go this year. I covered the race from 1979 to 1990 for the newspaper I worked for at the time, and, you know, really enjoyed it. It's a great event to cover because there's always something going on. Somebody's dropping out, somebody's crashing, whatever. And, you know, really loved it. It's funny, I grew up in Indianapolis and never went to the race until I started covering it years later. And, you know, really got drawn to it. The 500 is probably the most unique sporting event in the country. There was a man this year talking about attending the race. Mm-hmm. There was a guy in Pennsylvania, a doctor named Richard Bennett, who this year attended his 75th consecutive Indianapolis 500. And that's
wow.
Got to be a record, not only for the race, but for any sporting event. This guy has literally been to the race every year of his life, going back to 1939, and in fact, went to the race in his mother's womb in 1938.
Oh, is that one of the 75? Or is
it, pardon?
Is the one in his womb count as one of the 75?
He doesn't count that, no. He does not. But his mother was pregnant with him at the race in 1938, and he's been to the race every year that he's been out of that womb. And he brings about 20 people from Pennsylvania and goes to the parade, does the whole thing. And that kind of personifies for me what that race is about, because there's a lot of people who have streaks going. No one like that. Bill Marvel, the Pacers' original media relations director, went to his 70th consecutive race this year.
Oh,
so, you know, you hear people like that, 40 in a row, 50 in a row, or, you know, and that race means so much to them, and it's much more than just the cars going around the track. It's all the hoopla leading up to the race, and just the fact that they went with their dad when they were a kid, you know, that they've been in the same seat since 1950 or whatever. I mean, you know, it's just about tradition, really, and family.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, there's just not another sporting event like it.
Well, as we observed when we went home, and Chesna was mystified because they said, no, now we get to watch the race on television.
Yeah.
And not realizing that was also part of the tradition, as well as the night before the race as being part of the tradition of coming to the 500, that seeing it live in person, the cars look like they're going about twice as fast as they do on television. Didn't you think so, Mark?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And there was, you know, I had mixed emotions about the race. For a number, we had great seats. You know, Larry had us right off the first turn, so you were seeing that first wave of cars coming and the noise went by, and then, like Larry said, they went by so quickly. And I was amazed because a lot of people say, you know, when I go to football, baseball, basketball games, oh, it's so much better to watch it on TV and all that kind of thing. And my thinking on that is if you're at a football game, for instance, and you're watching a wide receiver like a Jerry Rice or, you know, go up against a Hall of Fame defensive back, you know, if you're at a football game live, you can watch that match up every single play if you want. When you're watching a game on TV, you're kind of forced to watch what the cameras show you. And when we went back home to Larry's house and watched the race after the race, it was kind of the opposite, where we were at the race, but I'm kind of anal about baseball games, basketball games. I keep score of all the games I go to. So if there's a triple play, I don't miss it. If there's a, you know, every single out, every single hit I see, every single basket I see. But at the race, it was so, you know, the racetrack was so huge that, you know, three of the four crashes we didn't even see from our seat, but we saw on TV. And being the second closest finish ever, we were kind of blocked off from the finish line. So it was kind of misleading where, you know, you're missing some of the action that you do see on TV, kind of the opposite of what I tell people about, no, I'd rather be in live. But yet still being in live was incredible because of the, like somebody just said before, the passion of the people. I was amazed the night before we were talking to some of the people that were around, and people were talking about, oh, the race back in 1955 when so-and-so did this, and somebody said, oh, that was back in 1953. And these people of Indianapolis, they know their race, they know their history. And being not a real race fan, I was listening to it in fascination with the number of, It'd be like going to Lambeau Field and hearing people talk about from Bart Starr to Brett Favre to Aaron Rodgers. These people are into the race cars and the race drivers and the different races that happened through the years with the same amount of detail and knowledge and that I didn't really expect, I guess, because I didn't follow it that closely. But it was an awesome to be a part of it and to see that live. And like Larry said, to see the cars go by. And then, you know, I was trying to take pictures, and I would have to snap like 10 pictures to get one car going by. But I would, you know, and it was, well, of course, you know, they're going 200 miles an hour, but it was a different experience, totally different experience from what I'm used to at going to a regular game, for instance.
Well, Mark Monteith, we've advertised Mark Chesna as one of America's greatest sports fans. And Mark, would you mind telling Mr. Monteith, give him an idea on your scheduling. Do you have your calendar there?
I've got this year's calendar. I mean, I got this year's calendar right in front of me.
Tell us one of your busier weekends attending sporting events and what's involved.
Well, I'll look it back and I can take one a month. In January, I went to Calgary. What I'm trying to do is I'm trying to hit all the stadiums. I've been to all the baseball, all the basketball, all the football except for one. Well, so I'm trying to hit the hockey. So the one week in January, I went to Calgary on a Friday night for a hockey game. The next night I saw a minor league hockey game at Edmonton, and then the next night I saw a game at Edmonton. If I look at a weekend in February, I went to a doubleheader on Saturday afternoon between Seton Hall and Xavier, and then that night I went to a Florida-Columbus Blue Jackets hockey game. The next day I went and saw Southern Florida play Cincinnati Bearcats in basketball. Then I flew back to Washington and caught the Trailblazers playing the Wizards. That's in February. Now in March I went to a four games in a row in one day. That was just a small conference tournament. Then I went to the first four in Dayton, Ohio, where I saw four games over Tuesday and Wednesday. Four Sundays in a row April were baseball games, Nationals, Orioles, Red Sox. In fact, the Red Sox, I went up for Patriots Day, and got up this early. I went to the Sunday night game, and instead of getting a hotel, I just kind of walked around all night because the game was 11 o'clock in the morning for Patriots Day, so I wanted to find the finish line of the marathon, and I saw this bike race, so I just really never went to bed, and I never got a hotel, and I just kind of, in between games, I just kind of stayed up and walked around, you know, and I saw your Pacers play that following Saturday in a playoff game in Atlanta, and then the next day I was down in Jacksonville for a baseball game. That's kind of an adjustive feeling. So, I mean, I've had ones in the past I've gone to things like I follow the Packers very closely, and so wherever the Packers play, one year they're in Buffalo, and I went up Friday night and saw a game in Toronto for the Raptors, and then Saturday afternoon I saw University of Buffalo football game, and then Saturday night I saw a Sabres game, and then Sunday would see the Packer Bills. Or one time the Packers were in New York, I went to New York and saw Fordham play basketball Saturday afternoon, saw the Islanders Saturday night, the Packer Jets on Sunday, the Knicks on Monday. So there's, so I'll try to see what I can cram into one weekend while I'm there. It's just as long as I'm there, and I could give you a bunch of examples like that. One of my favorite examples is I went to the 76 Olympics in Montreal, and when I came back, a friend of mine and I went to a Brewers game on a Monday night in Milwaukee. We went to a Cub doubleheader in Chicago Tuesday, followed by a White Sox game the same night. And the next day on Wednesday, went to a Cub game and hit a Brewer doubleheader on the same night on Wednesday. So in between Monday and Wednesday night, we saw seven baseball games. So, again, I could go on and on, but I try to max out my – when I'm in a city for a weekend, I'll try to see what games I can. I'm really trying to see as many different stadiums as I can. I've been to all the baseball, basketball, and football in the pros except for – another example is I went to Denver one time for a Packer-Bronco game, and I love Favre. I saw Favre play in 44 different stadiums, so I went out there Friday night and saw a college hockey game on Friday. On Saturday, I had a University of Wyoming football ticket, but I had to give that up because I got a free World Series ticket. And I felt a little – I'm not sure if I told you this story, Larry, or not, but I felt a little guilty because I'm outside the Denver Colorado Rockies Stadium with a free ticket. I'm looking at these diehard fans just doing anything to get in there to see their team play a World Series game, and I can identify with that. You know, your team's in there, and here I'm walking in free. So the next day, we went to a Colorado Avalanche hockey game. So Monday night, the Packers were playing the Broncos, and I could not find a ticket on the street. As much as I wanted to get into that Packer-Bronco game, because I knew it was the only time that Brett would ever play, Favre would ever play in that stadium, and right now it is still the only NFL stadium I haven't been to because AFC, NFC, I knew the Packers wouldn't come back for eight more years, so I could not get a ticket. Now, if the World Series would have gone one more game instead of a sweep, they would have been head-to-head with that Monday Night Football, and I think I would have got a ticket. But that's another example of a weekend where I hit four games in one weekend, but trying to hit five, and the one I wanted to hit the most, I didn't get a ticket for. And that's very rare. They don't get a ticket for a game when I go. But that's I think it was kind of karma. I think I didn't really deserve the World Series ticket as compared to some of the Rocky fans, but I felt like I deserved the Packer ticket more than people going in. And it was just kind of justice that I didn't get in there. But
what about that, Mr. Monteith? Does he have a problem?
I just wonder, you know, like, what do you do for a living? How do you, how does one have the time and money to be this kind of a sports fan?
Well, I work for the Fish and Wildlife Service, so it's a government job. And when Larry introduces me from West Virginia, but what I tell people is I'm from Wisconsin. I live in Georgia and I work in West Virginia. So I have an opportunity to fly cheap. My wife works for an airline, so I can get around pretty cheaply, and that allows me to travel to the games. And I have some friends in cities that I'll stay with, and I'll try to combine. I usually had 80 to 90 games a year, which I thought was a lot until I met a couple of guys. There's a group of guys called Ball Club Chasers that I met a guy at a Ravens game a few years ago who does what I do, flies to games. And we were looking for a ticket outside the stadium, and we were talking, and he said, hey, you should be part of our club. And it's a club of 600 people. And now I've been to 2,800 games. Actually, I'm about three games short of 2,800, which sounds like a lot. That's about 80 or 90 a year. But I'm finding out that some of these guys, there's been a guy that's been to 8,000 games. This guy's been to 13,000. And I'm thinking, yeah, but these guys live in New York City, so like for me from West Virginia during the week to get to a game, it's an hour and 2.5 hours to Baltimore, 2.5 hours to D.C. They live in New York City, so every night they're at a Mets game, a Yankee game, a Ranger game. You know, they go every weekend. They have a weekend like I talked about before. So these guys, they'll leave a game early to go to another one. And I don't ever leave a game early because I don't ever know when you're going to miss something. You know, but it's not as extreme as I thought as it sounds. I mean, there's a lot of guys that do what I do, and some even more to an extent, especially living in a big city like New York or Washington, where the games are right there. So to answer your question, I guess a lot of games I go to, when I say 80 or 90 games a year, a lot of them are minor league baseball, so they're not expensive. It's maybe $6 or $7 to get in. I buy most of my tickets on the street, so I never really pay face value for tickets. I usually pay less than face value from a scalper. And like I say, combining them in one weekend, I live in Atlanta on weekends, so I'll hit a lot of Braves, Falcons, not the Falcons because that's your football season. I watch the Packers, but so usually I'll get tickets on the street is, I guess, the main thing that makes it a lot cheaper to go.
Yeah, you've probably been asked a lot, but does one game out of all those 2,800 you've seen stand out as either the best game or just the most memorable experience?
There's a couple that I'd have to – there's two that I'd have to put two up there because 1982, I was a Brewers fan growing up in Wisconsin, and the Brewers went to the playoffs in 81, and I had the tickets for the playoffs, which they lost. It was a strike season, so they had an extra round of the playoffs, and I had bought the tickets for the miniseries, the ALCS, and the World Series. In case the Brewers made it all the way, I had tickets for all of them. Well, they lost in the first round. Well, I kept the tickets. Instead of sending them back, I kept them as a refund. So I got a big souvenir collection at home, a big sports collection of different stuff. And so the following year, the Brewers went out to California. And I was working a job I really didn't like. It was a restaurant job, and I was working 70 hours a week, and I got like one day a week off. And the Brewers went out to California, and I had done the same thing. I had bought the package for that American League Championship Series as well as the World Series. Well, back then in 82, the ALCS was only five games, not seven like it is today. And so when the Brewers went out to California, they lost game one and two, which means for them to get to the World Series, they had to come back and sweep all three in Milwaukee. And so I had to take one weekend off or the other. So I told the job I worked at, it was a restaurant, I said, I need this weekend off. And I took it off, and I went to game three, game four, game five of the American League Championship Series, and the Brewers won all three. And to answer your question, that game five was one of the most exciting games I've been to in my life because it meant not only were the Brewers going to the World Series, but selfishly it meant I was going to the World Series. Even though I knew I was going to work the next weekend, but I was one of those guys on the, you know, storming the field and, you know, knowing the Brewers are going to the World Series, their only time they've ever been there. The funny part of that story is I went back to work on Monday and I said, I need next weekend off. And my boss said, you can't, you just had last weekend off. And I said, okay, I quit. He said, wait a minute. You're going to quit over a baseball game? And I said, well, the way I look at it is 20 years from now, I'm going to look back on this weekend. I'm going to say, boy, am I glad I worked that weekend. Boy, am I glad I went to the World Series. And, of course, there was no contest. No, I didn't have to quit. I had a bunch of – I was in management, and the other guys covered for me, and I had to end up having off to go to the games, and I had to work a bunch of days in a row. But that World Series, even though the Brewers lost in seven, that what was more – exciting than the World Series itself was the Game 5 that they got them there. That's the one game of two that really stands out. The other one that stands out to me is back in 1976, I went to the Olympics in Montreal, and if you, then in 1972 Olympics was when the United States had the big controversy when they lost to Russia, when Russia got three chances for the last shot, and Alexander Belov hit the shot, you know, and defeated the United States. So the rematch was 1976, is what I thought was going to happen. So the gold medal game was on a Tuesday night, and I was trying, you know, hard to get tickets for it. I was up there with a college class called Comparative Physical Education. It was summer school, and I went to the Olympics for summer school. And, well, I went on Saturday to the game, a doubleheader game. It was the U.S. girls winning the silver medal with Ann Myers playing, and actually Pat Summitt, who played, who became the all-time winningest coach for Tennessee, Nancy Lieberman. But the second half of that doubleheader was Yugoslavia and Russia. Well, I was expecting Russia to win so they would face U.S. in the rematch of the gold medal game from 4 years ago when the United States got ripped off. But Yugoslavia jumped out to this huge crowd lead, and the crowd was just going nuts, going, Yugoslavia. You know, it was just going nuts. Well, Russia came back and took the lead, but Yugoslavia still hung on to win the game, which meant the gold medal game was now U.S. versus Yugoslavia. So it was easier to get a ticket, number one, but it took away the factor of the rematch. But still, I had to come back and write an essay for, you know, my final paper for that class, and I think I wrote something about how at that time I'd been life, I'd been to maybe 400 or 500 games, and I'd heard the national anthem maybe 400 or 500 times. But this was one of those times where, you know, foreign country, albeit even with Canada, to see United States, now Dean Smith was the coach, and John Thompson was the assistant coach, and there was Quinn Buckner and Scott Maid, Adrian Dantley, a lot of players I had known from their college days were on the medal stand with their gold medals. And to hear the national anthem, for some reason, gave me a kind of a different feel than I've ever heard it before, because it was, you know, it was something representing our country. And to be the gold medal game of the Olympics, those are the two that kind of, from my early days, stand out. I mean, I could probably name 10 or 12 games that, if I just went off the top of my head, I could probably name a bunch of stuff that stands out. But those are the first two that come to mind.
Well, Mark, have you ever met anyone like Mr. Chiss?
I don't think so, no.
Mark Montita has a wonderful radio program called One-on-One that is available in podcasts. Called The Fastest Hour on Radio, and I have to tell you, I am a big fan. And do you have a favorite interview in your program featuring Indiana athletes?
I can't really pick out one. I was the first show that aired was Johnny Wooden. He was 98 at the time, and it was over the phone, of course. I had been out to Encino a couple of times to meet with him and do stories for the Indianapolis Star when I worked there, and so that was the first show that aired, and I was glad to get that one, of course. And I did a show with Larry Bird, and, you know, Bird doesn't usually do these kind of things, but I'd covered the Pacers for the Star, so he gave me a break there, and I went to Cincinnati one time and did a show with Oscar Robertson. And but it's really hard to pick out, you know, a favorite, because some of the people who maybe aren't the biggest names have really good stories. And
absolutely,
you know, that's what it's all about, you know, just having whatever their story is. So, you know, for example, there's a guy named Wayne Pack who was on Washington High School State Championship team in 1969.
Steve, that's my high school.
Is it? Okay.
Yeah.
You know, they went undefeated then. And, you know, Wayne had been cut from the team as a freshman, sophomore, and junior. And then there was a coaching change, and Bill Green came in, and he not only made the team as a senior, he wound up starting, and he got a college scholarship to Tennessee Tech, and he wound up playing briefly for the Pacers. So, you know, that's just an odd story that, you know, it's good to be able to tell that. So, you know, he's not a very familiar name to people, but he had a good story, so that was a show I enjoyed doing. So, show's been on for, 5 years now, and
wow.
I've done a lot of shows, obviously, and you know, I did a show with that race fan I talked about earlier, Richard Bennett, who went to his 75th consecutive race this year. I did that one a couple of years ago. And, you know, it's always good to do the oddball things, too, as well as the bigger names.
Hey, Mark, you ended up getting my job. I mean, I went to college for radio, TV, film for the purpose of getting into sports, not to get into radio, TV, which I work in television now, as Larry probably said, but I wanted what you did. And I actually, one of those guys that peaked in college. I was doing exactly what I wanted to do in college. I was sports director of the radio station. I was actually able to go down and interview players. And, you know, I interviewed Bart Starr twice and a number of players. But I got to tell you, because it's an Indiana-based story, the first time I was – went down the Bucks dressing room, Milwaukee Bucks, when Quinn Buckner was playing for them. And I was doing a radio interview, and I just had my little cassette recorder. And I thought, this is a great question. I said to Quinn Buckner, I said, you know, you've won a high school state championship. You've won a Final Four for Indiana. You've won a gold medal. Do you feel like you need to win a NBA championship to complete the, you know, championship at every level type thing? And his answer was, you know, I never thought of that. Well, a year later, I'm going down there. Now I've graduated in the junior part of my seasons or college, and now I'm working more on television. So I went down there again. I'm thinking, oh, that was a great question. I want to get him again so I can get that on video rather versus just the audio cassette of him. So I asked Quinn Buckner. I get down there. I'm sure he didn't remember who I was. And I said, you know, you've won the high school state championship, and you've won the NCAA Final Four, and you've won the Olympic gold medal. Do you feel like you need to win an NBA championship to win a championship at every level? And his answer was, yeah, that was always my goal, to win a championship at every level. And I'm thinking, a year ago, you just told me you never thought of that. I thought that was kind of a funny, you're talking about your interviews, I thought about Quinn Buckner because he was, very gentlemanly when I interviewed him, but that was one of my favorite stories.
You had planted the seed for him, and you started thinking about it.
Yeah, and I've had I've had some interviews with some people that have had really favorite answers. Let me just throw one out there. I asked George Brett one time earlier in the season. I said, it was very early in the season. I was out in California. There were all five California teams asking for press passes. Well, the Padres, the Giants, and the Angels gave me press passes. The other two didn't. But when I was out there in Anaheim, I said to George Brett, again, early in the year, I said, right now you're leading the league in at-bats, hits, runs, doubles, RBIs, and batting average. At the end of the year, if you could lead the league in one stat, what would it be? Fully expecting him to say batting average, maybe even home runs, maybe RBIs. And his answer was at-bats, because that means you play every day, and that's how you get the respect of your teammates. And of all the answers I've ever gotten from a player or a coach, that was always my favorite answer. I thought that was the coolest answer.
Yeah, that is a good answer. No question.
So,
well, and I should mention, too, because Mark Chesna, we mentioned the player number 30 for the Philadelphia 76ers.
George McGinnis,
and he was part of that fantastic, almost not fair, Washington Continental team with Wayne Pack, as was mentioned earlier, and, of course, Steve.
Yeah, Young. I was there for all of them.
It
1969, we won state 31-0. George McGinnis, Steve Downing, Billy Keller, Louis Day.
Not Billy Keller. He was on the 65.
No, you're right. Billy Keller.
That was Jim Arnold, Wayne Pack, and Louis Day.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, Billy came back to, he was a coach there at Washington for a while.
No, he wasn't, actually. He was the coach at Brebeuf High School, and then he coached at Indiana Central on the south side, and he was an assistant at Purdue for 1 or 2 years under Lee Rhodes.
Well,
so.
I don't know what I'm thinking then, because
maybe he
came back, because I know him and Bill Green worked together. I saw him.
Are you sure, Dr. Day?
I'm pretty sure, yeah.
That probably would have been at Indiana Central. Bill Green coached Indiana Central, and Billy might have been an assistant to him there briefly. I'm not sure. I know they both coached there, so they might have crossed over.
Was Lee Rhodes the coach at Purdue when Joe Barry Carroll played there?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. The first time I saw Purdue play in Madison was Joe Barry Carroll. And when you said Lee Rhodes, I never would have thought of that name of who the coach was. But when you said that, it clicked. I thought, I think that was, yeah.
Yeah, I did a show with Lee just a few months ago. And he's really, he kind of messed up his coaching career. He was at, he took, North Carolina Charlotte to the Final Four with Cornbread Maxwell.
Yeah, Cornbread against Marquette.
Yeah,
Marquette
2 years later, he had Purdue in the Final Four.
1977, right? Oh, he did?
Yeah.
Okay. Where did he go from Purdue then?
Well, he didn't mix well there. He didn't fit in very well there. I don't know if that's his fault or Purdue's fault, but he left to go to South Florida and start a program there. And he was there for 5 or 6 years. It really never became anything when he was there. But he's an outstanding coach, and he should have stayed at Purdue or maybe hung in there long enough to get another major college job, because he basically wound up being a long-time NBA assistant or scout for NBA teams. And it seems like a waste, because he was an outstanding college coach.
I did a weekend last February when I came down to Purdue. I went and saw – I really wanted to see Butler last year. Butler, Duke, and Kansas were the top three stadiums I want to see, because of Cameron Arena and Butler Fieldhouse, of course, and the Lawrence, the history of, behind – in the stadium of Kansas, and I was able to get Duke tickets last year, but I also came to Butler, but I went down to an Indiana State game in Terre Haute Saturday afternoon, and I came up to Butler Saturday night, and then Sunday was able to see a game at Purdue. So that was a fun weekend I believe February. It was last basketball season somewhere.
Yeah, yeah.
This past basketball season, but, you know, a year ago. So, yeah.
There's not a college arena or field house, whatever you want to call it, that's more historic than Butler. You know,
Kansas. I mean, Kansas, Dr. James Naismith coaching there and Will Chamberlain playing there. I haven't been there yet, but I'm thinking that Allen Fieldhouse may be as much as, you know, I mean, I don't know yet, I haven't been there yet, but I'm thinking that with Dr. Naismith coaching there and Will playing there, just those two things alone, and then Danny Manning and everything on from then on, I think they may be as historic. I went out to Pauley Pavilion in UCLA, and I was a little disappointed with that, I flew up to UCLA. I went to California. I went to UCLA on Thursday. I went to the Laker game on Friday. Then on Saturday, I hit the Kings from 1 to 2:30. I ran over to USC, and I parked my car in between the two. I ran over to USC and dropped stuff off of the car. I hit the USC game from 4:30 to 6:30, ran back to my car, dropped the stuff off, and went over to the Clipper game, hit the Clippers game, then I took the red-eye flight back to Atlanta. But UCLA, the thing is, I'm sitting at UCLA all day just killing time because I wasn't used to L.A. traffic. And then I leave there, and I found out there's a Hall of Fame there. You know, so I went back the next day when I was on there all day on the campus. I could have seen it. It's a nice Hall of Fame, but it's not part of the stadium. But you're right. I think Butler Fieldhouse was amazing. Just, you know, it was amazing.
Yeah, 1928. Built.
That's when it was built?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's when it opened.
I don't like these new arenas. These new arenas have become corporate arenas. It's like the NFL stadiums, too. There's very few. Now, the Pacers Fieldhouse, the Bankers Life Fieldhouse is the exception. I think that's the best stadium in the NBA. I'm not just saying it because I'm talking to you. I think, of course, you've got so much history. I mean, the display case you've got around the concourse, there's so much to work with. You know, the high school, I think that's a great stadium. But most of the NBA arenas, the NFL stadiums, even the college stadiums, like you look at Camp Randall, I mean, the basketball stadium at was Madison, Wisconsin, compared to the new one. And a lot of the new ones have just become these corporate arenas. They're not. There's no personality to them like they used to have. Butler still has that. You know, Duke still has that. And I like to see those stadiums before they go out. When I find out there's one going away, I fly to that city and make sure I hit a game there. I went to Oregon the last year, and I try to see is Oregon. I keep getting corrected when I say Oregon at work. I say Oregon, and people say it's Oregon. You know, but so I like to see the old stadiums, you know, before they go away. So anyway, I didn't mean to cut you off. I just was thinking.
All right. We like it when you think, Mr. Chesna. We're going to take a short break. We're with Mark Monteith, broadcasting icon here in Indiana and America's greatest sports fan, Mark Chesna. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to Wild World on Blog Talk Radio.
Stay tuned. We'll be back with more of Larry Batson's Wild World here on Blog Talk Radio.
Sassy! Sassy!
This week's episode, Bobcat in the Cave.
Gosh, Johnny, playing in the cave sure is neat.
Oh, boy, a kitty cat.
Sassy, the kitty cat's yelling.
What, Sassy? It's not a kitty? It's a bobcat? Speaking of cats, you like to stress the importance of adopting cats from animal shelters? Over 5 million cats go into animal shelters every year? And with millions of healthy cats to choose from, it's a shame more people don't adopt from shelters?
It's bobcat heavy. Help, Sassy!
Why bother? We'll just get into more trouble tomorrow?
What's that supposed to mean? Oh, nuts.
Sassy is brought to you by the Ad Council and the ShelterPetProject.org. Remember, adopt.
Here's a hot topic about our wildlands and living with the natural role of fire.
Yard work is not just a matter of pride when you live in the wildland-urban interface. It's also about survival. Here are some FireWise tips that can help protect your home from wildland fire. Prune your trees 6 to 10 feet above the ground. Remove dead leaves and branches and dispose of them before fire season. Water your lawn regularly and store firewood away from the house. Be prepared for a fire emergency by having a plan for your family and pets. Learn more at our website and then sit back and enjoy. You worked for it.
This hot topic was made possible by the Teresa and H. John Hines III Foundation. Learn more about the natural role of fire, how to protect your community, and get the latest fire information. Visit the National Interagency Fire Center website at NIFC.gov. That's NIFC.gov.
We're Rascal Flats. There's a place where ordinary people do extraordinary things every day. That place is called the American Red Cross. When you help the American Red Cross, you help America. Call 1-800-RED-CROSS or visit redcross.org to learn more.
Ranger Station, Ranger speaking.
Yeah, hi. I'd like to report a bear sighting.
Location?
In the forest near the side of the road.
No need for alarm, sir. The forest is where bears live.
But this was no ordinary bear.
No ordinary bear?
Yeah, one second I'm having a smoke taken in the view. Next thing I know, I am face to face with Smokey Bear.
Let me guess, Smokey had a tip for you.
He did. He must have seen me toss my cigarette on the ground. He told me never to do that because it only takes one spark to start a wildfire.
He's a smart bear. Did you know that 9 out of 10 wildfires are caused by humans? That means 9 out of 10 wildfires can be prevented.
That's what Smokey said. I had no idea.
That's why Smokey's famous, and you're not.
Good point.
Get your Smokey on. If you see someone in danger of starting a wildfire, step in and make a difference, because 9 out of 10 wildfires are caused by humans. Brought to you by Smokey Bear, the U.S. Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council. Learn more at SmokeyBear.com.
Only you can prevent wildfires.
Welcome back to Larry Batson's Wild World here on Blog Talk Radio. Once again, here's your host, Larry Batson.
We'll be back with Mark Monteith, broadcaster, and Mark Chesna, sports fan. In just a moment, we want to remind everyone that this part of Wild World is brought to you by McGregor Mountain Lodge in beautiful Estes Park, Colorado. If you've never been to that part of the country, folks, you owe it to yourself. Right there next to Rocky Mountain National Park, it's absolutely spectacular. McGregor Mountain Lodge has fabulous facilities, from small cabins up to complete lodges, hot tubs. It's all there. And guess what? You'll have wildlife in your backyard. I've seen bighorn sheep, elk, and deer. It's absolutely phenomenal. And when you visit Rocky Mountain National Park and you see that front range, it's absolutely a spiritual experience. Go to their website at McGregorMountainLodge.com. I want to remind everyone to go to our archives and check out all of our shows. In fact, not only tonight's program, which will be available right after the broadcast, but also some of our other programs with such rock and roll greats as Al Jardine, Dave Davies, Tony Kaye from Yes, Chris France from Talking Heads. Over 200 shows, it's all there at Larry Batson's Wild World on Blog Talk Radio. Just Google Larry Batson Wild World on Blog Talk Radio. Our guest tonight, Mark Monteith with the Indiana Pacers, and Mark Chesna, sports fan, and Mark Monteith. We have to talk about those Pacers. My gosh, what a ride that's been.
Yeah, this has been really probably the strangest team I've ever covered. I covered the Pacers for the Star for 12 years, which happens to be the record. And, you know, now I do it kind of a part-time thing for Pacers.com, and it's really been amazing. You know, this is the team that had the best record in the league for the first couple months of the season and, you know, was so together, just had everything going its way. And then things just kind of crumbled, and it was really a few factors in that. They're a young team, except for David West. They're a young team and not in all ways a mature team. And they weren't used to being front runners. You know, they weren't used to being on a team that was as good as any in the league, and they got a little soft in that way. Paul George got a lot of attention that he wasn't accustomed to. I mean, he's a guy who was second-team all-conference coming out of Fresno State just a few years ago. Suddenly he's, you know, on the cover of ESPN, the magazine. He's doing Gatorade commercials. You know, he's becoming a national figure. That proved to be a distraction for him. Roy Hibbert, you know, was an all-star again this year, and he was in Sports Illustrated and getting a lot of attention, but at the same time, he wasn't getting the ball. You know, he wasn't getting, you know, the ball as often as he thought he should in the offense, and, you know, he had a legitimate beef there. He had an emerging player, Lance Stephenson, who was 23 years old, like Paul George, and, you know, who had a chance to be an all-star and didn't make it, and then he seemed to go out and want to prove to the world that he should have been, so he was dominating the ball too much. And he just suddenly the chemistry went awry. And, it took a while to get straightened out, and maybe they don't completely now. I think they really are kind of all back on the same page now, but Hibbert comes and goes. Their offense comes and goes, and you just don't know what to expect from one game to the other. But the thing that has been consistent for them is that they have played well when they really had to. You know, when they were facing elimination in the playoffs, they've played well. They're 4-0 now in elimination games in this postseason. So they got another one tomorrow in Miami, and it'll be interesting how that goes. It's hard to imagine they could win three straight games over Miami, which is what they have to do to get to the finals. But, you know, who knows? This team's crazy enough they might be able to pull it off.
Well, we hope so, at least for the Indiana fans. In fact, believe me, I'm no basketball expert, and I don't really consider myself an avid fan, though I do enjoy watching the Pacers. Not the complete game, though. That drives me crazy. But at the start of the season, I thought those guys have this all figured out. They've figured out what it takes to win in the NBA because they were phenomenal.
Yeah, oh, they had great chemistry. You know, they have a starting five, you know, with it's almost a problem in a way, is that they don't have a role player in their starting five. And so they all are capable of scoring and all expect to score or at least get shots a certain amount of time. And that can create a problem, you know, if somebody is kind of getting ignored in the offense. George Hill doesn't care too much about scoring, but he's certainly capable of it. And, it was just really a case of immaturity creeping in. You know, last year they were the underdog, charging, getting better. You know, everybody's really happy with the progress they'd made. And when they got beat in the seventh game of the conference finals in Miami, everybody thought, well, man, that was a great season, and next year is going to be great. And then this season came around, and it was great for a few months. And then it just went haywire because of the attention they got. You know, fans in Indianapolis like to complain that their teams don't get enough respect and that the national media doesn't respect the Pacers or the Colts or whoever. And we saw what happened this year when they get the national media. You know, it went to their heads. It distracted them. And maybe in a couple, 3 years, it won't be that way. But for now, guys like Paul George and Lance Stephenson and even Roy Hibbert, you know, were distracted by that. And I guess it's like any relationship. You know, it could be even the relationship between two people. It can go haywire for a while, and it takes a while to get it straightened out. But it can be straightened out a lot of times. And I think the Pacers are fairly well straightened out now, but they still have a ways to go. And regardless of what happens, you know, with this series, I don't think we're going to see major changes in the roster. It's hard to make those changes. It takes a long time to put a team together that can contend for a title, so you have to be really careful about breaking it up. So I know if they lose tomorrow, there's going to be a lot of media speculation about breaking it up, and a lot of fans will be saying that, but I just don't see it. I think there'll be some changes, but I don't think you're going to see anything massive just because Larry Bird and, you know, Donnie Walsh are still on the scene, too. They know how difficult it is, and you just got to wait sometimes for teams to grow up a little more. You got to be patient. Sometimes it takes longer than you want, but I think you got to keep this team together for the most part and hope that it continues to mature.
Well, and a lot of people speculated, and I don't even there's so many sports experts out there that it just – but Andrew Bynum, I can remember when Larry Bird was asked, did the Pacers sign Andrew Bynum to keep him out of Miami? And he pretty much said that was the dumbest question.
Yeah, he did.
The way Bynum's playing, I think he'd want him in Miami.
Well, he played in two games, and he played really well. I mean, he played very well in the two games he managed to play. They took a risk there.
Well, when
that
he did in Philadelphia, he left a bad taste in people's in Philadelphia's mouth for the short time, and L.A.'s, you know, for the time he was there.
Oh, yeah. He had problems in L.A., and he didn't play at all in Philly, and then things went wrong in Cleveland. But he was here in a completely different environment. Right. And, you know, there were no indications that he caused any problems. He's a different kind of personality. But he's got a very low threshold for BS, I think. And, you know, some of those, when he was in Philly and in Cleveland, even this year, things weren't going very well. But he wasn't a problem with the Pacers. And, in fact, he played really well and got everybody excited. But his knees just couldn't handle it, you know. And I would guess that his career is probably over. And it's too bad because he's a great talent. I think there's a lot of athletes that will conform to their environment. And if they're in a good situation on a good team with good management, they'll be okay. But you put them in a on a bad team or a team that doesn't run well, and they're going to cause problems because they don't have the maturity to withstand that. And Bynum, I think, is that kind of personality. So it was too bad. But really, it was no great loss for the Pacers. He played two games. They paid him some money, but, you know, life went on. There was the speculation that he was the reason Roy Hibbert started playing poorly, but to me, that was really dumb, that Hibbert probably didn't want him there. He probably wanted him and, you know, Jan Mahimi to handle the center position, but he didn't struggle because of Andrew Bynum. That's just silly, you know, and the stats don't back that theory anyway. So it kind of created a stir in the media and amongst the fans, but it was just an experiment that didn't work out, much like Greg Oden hasn't worked out in Miami.
Well, and
do you feel they would have been stronger if they would have kept Danny Granger?
No, I don't.
Okay.
Now, Evan Turner has not really been much of a factor for the Pacers. See, when he's played a lot, he has had some good games, but he hasn't been a problem. And, in fact, I think a lot of people have kind of imagined that Danny Granger was a leader and a mentor and all that, but he wasn't. You know, this team had changed so dramatically from the time that Granger had been the leading scorer that he was no longer really a major part of it. You know, he had missed the previous year with injuries all but five games, and he was just a guy this year trying to revive his career, and he was usually the first guy out of the locker room after games, and didn't really seem to socialize with his teammates that much. He got along with them. He's a nice guy, but he wasn't really by any stretch a leader or a mentor. Paul George maybe somewhat, because they had known each other before, but no one else. I see Evan Turner communicating with his teammates a lot more than Danny Granger ever did. So, you know, and Turner actually played as well for the Pacers as Granger did for the Clippers. You know, so that was another experiment that I thought was worth trying. You know, I don't know that it's I don't know that Granger would be playing any more than Turner did. Granger didn't play much in the playoffs for the Clippers. He had one good game for him in the playoffs, but that was it. So, you know, I don't think that's really been another that's no reason for their struggles either. I think.
Well, I was surprised Philadelphia gave up on Turner so quickly after drafting him so high the year before. Right, so I was surprised. I was wondering what that was all about.
Yeah, and that indicates that, you know, there might have been some issues there. I mean, he's got a different kind of personality, kind of sarcastic, and, you know, I'm not saying I would ever build a team around him. And he's the kind of player that has to have the ball in his hands to be effective, and that's not going to likely be the case in the NBA because he's not Kobe Bryant. You know, he's not such a great talent or athlete that he can lead a team. So he's got to change his game to really be effective in the league. But, yeah, that was a red flag that they had not given him his rookie contract extension. And, you know, that they were willing to trade him like they did for a second round, for a draft pick. So, yeah, you know, he helped him a couple games. He had a 20-point game, and he's had a few nice games for him and made contributions. I think if you played him in this series, he would contribute. But he just gets lost on defense, and he tends to dominate the ball on offense. And so for right now, at least, they've given up on him.
I have a question. What about what about this Lance Stephenson blowing in LeBron James's ear?
Yeah. Lance being Lance is the catchphrase for that. And I think Lance has struggled to figure out how he's going to approach these games. You know, he earlier was playing to the crowd. You know, he'd make a nice play and he'd do a little dance or whatever and get the crowd going. And then he kind of talked about, I got to calm down my antics, you know, because he was getting technical fouls and he got kicked out of a game against Miami in the regular season. They almost lost it. And that seemed to be a turning point. But now lately he's kind of revved up again. And he seems to believe that he needs to be that way to motivate himself and to remain engaged in the game. And you could argue that it does bring some energy to the building and to his teammates because the Pacers are a pretty laid-back team. But obviously you can't cross the line. And it's like Roy Hibbert said last night, you don't want to poke the bear. And that you don't want to make LeBron James mad or give him any reason at all to be extra motivated for you. And I think a lot of people are wondering, is tomorrow night's game going to be one of these where LeBron goes for 49? Because, you know, he's capable of that. And, you know, but, you know, LeBron seemed to shrug it off. He's above that stuff. I've got a lot of respect for LeBron James. A lot of people love to hate him, but I think he's a great player and a good leader. And, you know, I think he's going to be motivated regardless. So, you know, Stevenson has gotten better. He's playing the game. He's not forcing things like he was earlier. He does bring a lot of energy. I think there's value in some of the things he does. He just has to be careful not to cross the line. And, he, you know, blowing in LeBron's ear just isn't necessary. If nothing else, all the media and social media conversation about it could be a distraction.
I wonder how Slick Leonard would have handled that situation if he was.
I don't know. It's you know, his players didn't do that. I don't know, because Slick was as wild as anybody. You know, he you're talking about a coach who threw a ball rack on the floor, kicked the ball in the stands, picked up a scorekeeper in San Antonio by a shirt collar, lifted him out of a seat because he thought he started the clock too soon. You know, so I don't know what he would do.
Is this an Indiana thing with Bobby Knight and Slick Leonard? Is this kind of a Indiana? Is it in the water there or something? Or?
Yeah, you know, we've had our share of crazy coaches, and it does make it more entertaining. Here's a little piece of trivia for you, that IU offered that coaching job to Slick Leonard before they hired Bob Knight. You know,
oh, really?
Been the coach down there, yeah. And think about how that would have changed the course of basketball history.
Yeah.
But Slick says he turned it down twice.
This when Bob Knight was still at Army?
Yes, yes. Slick had won, the Pacers won the ABA title in 1970, and IU was looking for a coach a year later, and they called Slick twice and talked to him about it. But Slick was smart. He is not a college coach. He is a pro coach, and you know, he's a guy who wants to be out drinking with his players, and it was wise for him not to take that job.
Well, they used to say at halftime in the ABA days, that the players would be smoking, and I don't know if they were drinking or not in halftime. I know they
not
were
drinking,
after
but there, yeah, if you were Roger Brown and George McGinnis and Slick would be lighting up cigarettes at halftime. You know, I saw a picture recently of Lenny Dawson when he was with the Kansas City Chiefs smoking a cigarette at halftime of the Super Bowl that he played in. You know, so I mean, that was not uncommon back then to light up a cigarette at halftime. So it's hard to fathom that now, but yeah, that happened.
The only ABA game I ever went to in my life was the St. Louis Spirits against Denver Nuggets, and was Marvin Badness Barnes and that team. And at halftime, I went out to get a soda or a hot dog, and there's Monty Towell. Remember Monty Towell from NC State, the little short guy? He wasn't playing. He had a cast on his hand, but he was waiting in line for a hot dog.
Yeah.
You know, at halftime. You know, I'm thinking, you know, you'd think you would have to wait in line, number one, or you think they'd have food underneath, you know. But anyway, I thought that was kind of funny at halftime of a St. Louis Spirits. And it was actually Moses Malone played in that game, too, when he was really young.
Yeah, for St. Louis. Yeah, they had quite a collection of talent. You know, Badgers Barnes, Maurice Lucas, Freddie Lewis, the former Pacer, was with them.
And it was against David Thompson's and Dan Issel's Nuggets, so it was a good ABA game to see, of the only ABA game I ever went to. So
ESPN did a nice documentary on the Spirits of St. Louis. And that was just one of the – that's, you know, Bob Costas was their play-by-play guy.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, they that was quite a collection.
Well, I saw Bad News Barnes in the old CBA. Remember that they had Oshkosh used to have a team for some reason. Well, Oshkosh used to have an Oshkosh All-Stars before the NBA. Well, so the Oshkosh had a CBA team one time, and they played at my junior high school. They played at my high school. They played at my college. They played at all whatever gym was available. In one game, Marvin Bad News Barnes was playing against – I don't remember which team, I could look it up, but and he got kicked out of the game before the first half was over out of a CBA game. So the only two times I ever saw Brian News Barnes play was a game in ABA in St. Louis and a CBA game in Oshkosh. But that was
He was a wasted talent, great talent, but he just didn't have his act together.
Yeah, him and Ernie D in college, you know, Providence. Right?
Oh, Ernie D were the, you know, one of the most entertaining players I've ever seen. You know, the most entertaining players to me are the passers, and Barrio was a great passer.
And Maravich, you must like the Maravich,
sure.
Isn't it? Yeah.
Sure. Scott Skiles, guys like that.
Yeah, Skiles.
Well, the old ABA, it was like that was they were renegades, they were outlaws. It was a lot of fun. There was a lot of entertainment value to watch those games.
Yeah, just a different time, you know, the 60s, you know, the ABA, you'd have, in the NBA, too, at that time, you'd have fights, and, you know, you wouldn't even get kicked out of the game if you got into a fight. They'd just clean up and might call a technical foul, but, you know, life would go on, and you know, things happened that would never happen today that people could look back on and have a good laugh about. And, you know, I mean, one example, you know, the Pacers were in the ABA Finals in 1970 against the Los Angeles Stars, and they were going to play a nationally televised game to wrap up the series. They had a 3-1 lead in the series, and it was going to be on national TV here in Indianapolis. And the day before the game, Bob Nedelecki went out and went water skiing. You know,
who did?
Bob Nedelecki. He went water skiing.
Oh.
So he shows up for the game with a sunburn, and his shoulders and arms are sore from water skiing all day, and he's throwing up air balls. He went 7-for-22 from the floor. And so the Pacers lost the game, so they had to go back to L.A. and win the series. I mean, can you imagine today an NBA player in the NBA Finals going water skiing the day before a game?
My gosh.
Like that, I mean, he'd get killed, you know. But back then, you know, of course, it didn't come out for a while that he had done that. But, you know, things like that happened, and people didn't take it so seriously.
Well, I think I remember hearing on one of your shows, Mark, that Bobby Leonard would even, like Mel Daniels, he would encourage him to fight if things weren't going right.
Yeah, well, he would tell, like he might tell the guards, like, you know, play these guys more physically, you know, bump them and everything, and don't worry if a fight breaks out, Mel's there, he's got your back. And, you know, Mel would fight. You know, Mel's a great guy, but he would fight if necessary. And, you know, fights were just not a big deal. You know, they're... I can't tell you how many there were, but it wasn't uncommon, and I saw a few myself from going to games. I saw a game against the Carolina Cougars where a fight broke out in the first half, and a guard for Carolina named Bob Verga actually knocked Mel down. Mel was kind of off balance and turned around, and Verga threw a punch and managed to knock him down, and then things got broken up. So at halftime, Mel followed Bob Verga to their locker room to resume the situation, but Carolina's coach, Bones McKinney, intercepted him and kept him from doing it. But, you know, Mel was going to go in their locker room and fight him because he felt like he'd been embarrassed by getting knocked down by this little guard. So, you know, but then after the game, they might all go out together and, you know, go to Slick's house and drink beer. You know, even the visiting team would show up, and the referees would be there, the stat crew would be there. It was just an entirely different atmosphere back then.
Oh, and it was wonderful basketball. I mean,
did Billy Cunningham play for Carolina?
Yes, he did. He jumped leagues, and I think he played there. He was MVP of the ABA one year.
I don't remember if it was Carolina or not.
Then he went back to the
did
NBA.
An interview with him once, and he's coaching the Sixers.
Yeah. He won a championship with him. Yeah.
The full season.
Exactly.
Only it was five full. And I was at the in the middle of the series was, in fact, one thing I've never been to is on my the top of my bucket list is an NBA Finals. Because every year when I was growing up in Wisconsin, I'd buy the Bucks playoff booklets. So you'd have to, and they'd always win the first round against a Cleveland or a Detroit or a pre-Jordan Chicago. Then they would always have to play a Bird Celtics or a Dr. J Sixers team. And they would beat that first team, but then they'd have to play the other one. And they could never get over both humps. So all these years I had tickets for the finals, and I still haven't been to an NBA Finals game. But they never could get past both Bird and Dr. J at the same time.
They gave him some good battles, but it didn't quite have enough.
I used to love Dr. J. Even though he was against my team, until Favre came along, he was my all-time favorite athlete to watch play, all time. I had about shoulders above anybody else. I used to love Dr. J. Well, then Brett Favre came along, and he blew him away. I mean, I never enjoyed watching anybody as much as Favre, but then there's a little bias there being a Packer fan, but... You know, I used to love Dr. J. Yeah.
And he's a really good guy, too. Dr. J's last year with Philly, they were playing in Indianapolis against the Pacers, and I'm working for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. And I interviewed him after the game, and everybody else cleared out, and here's this guy from the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette that he doesn't know at all, and he's got people waiting on him. And he was as patient as he could be and was a great interview. And, you know, I thought he showed a lot of class. You know, he didn't have to do it, obviously, and he's just really a good guy.
Yeah.
That's, yeah. Well, who's the nicest person you've ever, who's your favorite interview, Mark?
Me
that's
or
tough.
Mr. Monteith.
That's tough. You know, I really have had very few problems. You know, the Pacers as a group have all been good. Most of those guys are really good guys. I wouldn't classify anybody as a bad guy. There's some guys who don't like to talk much, and then, you know, they're not very outgoing, and they don't like to be interviewed. My next one-on-one show is with Derek McKee, and he's one of those guys. He's a really quiet guy who sometimes didn't want to talk after a game. But, heck, now you can't shut him up when you talk to him now that he's retired. So, but, you know, most of those guys are really – I think in basketball you got to be a people person because you're with a small group of people playing a long season. If you don't know how to get along with people, you're not going to last long. And, you know, that kind of – carries over to the media, that most of them are comfortable with media, and they're fine, and I've really had very few problems. So it's hard to pick out one, but certainly athletes, when they're retired, tend to be nicer because they, you know, their lives are not as hectic, and they kind of miss being in the spotlight, and they mm-hmm. like being having somebody pay attention to them. But as far as current athletes, you know, the vast majority of them have really been good guys.
I would think being a beat reporter, though, would also be a big plus, because these guys are seeing you around. They get used to you. They get comfortable with you versus a guy who just tries to interview you one time that they don't know. I think that might be a big plus for you. You know.
If you travel with the team, that makes a difference.
Right.
They see you on the road, and they know the hassles you're going through to be with them, chasing them around the country. They're flying charter jets, and I'm flying commercial, you know, and they respect that. And so that's when you really get to know the guys, yeah.
Even in a small college, I went to the University of Wisconsin, Oshkosh, and I was the voice of the Titans basketball team, and I would go on all the road games, take the bus trips, and, you know, some of those trips from Oshkosh to Superior, Wisconsin are 8 hours, 9 hours long, and I would always make a point of sitting with all the players for half an hour and talking to them, and I would go to the practices and watch it there. So when I was actually doing the game, I could actually, you know what I was talking about, know who the players were, and I felt comfortable about talking about them versus, you know, and it was small. I mean, it's Division III school. It's nothing has never reached the heights that you've gotten yourself. You're kind of where I wanted to be. But it was still kind of, I felt that way with the players because I got to know them all individually.
Yeah.
But
it's
so
a lot more
for
fun
me,
then. You know, I mean, when you know the personalities, know the people, it's a lot more fun to watch them because you know the stories behind it.
I'll tell you the classiest guy I've ever talked to, and again, maybe some bias here, but Bart Starr is just, mm-hmm. I did Bart Starr twice, and the first time was a thrill because I took my father with me up there, and it was just you know, in Green Bay, was, you know, in Wisconsin, you know, Starr is God, and he's such a good hearted Christian, solid man, and he was just so patient. I interviewed him twice, and he was just the best person I've ever. I mean, I've talked to 50 or 60 major leaguers. I've got a list, but Bart Starr was probably the top of my list. And I've had the ones that were really rude to me, you know, that told me to, you know, F off. You know, in the middle of the interview, I asked Gaylord Perry about throwing a spitball, and he, you know, said it's none of your business, and walked away, and just kind of, you know, I mean, but you know, he had just come out with a book, you know, about me and the spitter. So, and I had some guys that were just because they say no doesn't mean they're rude, but I've had some guys that say no nicely, and some guys that were. Rod Carew was the biggest jerk ever. I mean, he was the biggest jerk.
I've heard
anybody.
That about him. Yeah.
Yeah. He was. I mean, I had studied up on Rod Carew. My dad had a job in Minnesota for something to do, and we were going over for the whole weekend. So I had my mind just filled statistically with Rod Carew. I knew how many times he stole home. So I went there and I walked in, and there was a rain delay, so I had a press pass to get in the locker room, and I go up to Carew. I'm Mr. Carew. I'm from the University of Wisconsin, Oshkosh. I don't have time right now. So I went ahead and interviewed some other guys, you know, minor players like Butch Weinegar and Glenn Borgman, and Gene Mock was a manager. And so I noticed that Carew wasn't doing anything, so I kind of approached him a little bit later. I said, Mr. Carew, you got time there? He said, I don't have time with you. So I said, okay, fine. So I go up in the Orioles dressing room, Orioles dugout, and I was able to get an interview with Jim Palmer and Earl Weaver and Mark Belanger. So the next day I'm out there for batting practice, and I just start taking a step towards Carew, and he put his bat toward me and says, I told you yesterday to stay away from me. And I'm thinking, what's this with this guy, you know? So, I mean, yeah, but then there's other guys that have been just overly above, you know, back, you know, nice, especially to a guy, a college guy like me. They don't have to, you know, there's nothing for them to be gained by letting me talk to them, but they've, you know, they've been good guys anyway.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you've dealt with a lot more than I have.
Yeah. Well, I'd give credit, you know, Johnny Wooden is this. You know, major sports figure as the country's ever had, and I've talked to him several times on the phone. And then when the Final Four was in Indianapolis in 2006, the Indianapolis Star wanted to do a lot of stories related to Indiana's basketball tradition, and I wound up going out to his condo twice. And you know, it was almost surreal. You know, I sat in his den where so many famous
wow.
people have visited him. At this little condo, two-bedroom condo in Encino, and sat there for probably 3 hours talking to Johnny Wooden. And he had a cold, so he's sitting there in his bathrobe with white socks pulled up to his knees, and just sat there and talked, you know.
There's still probably pictures of Nell all over, right? He loved his wife.
Oh, yeah.
Man, he loved his wife.
Yeah, you know, he had basically a shrine to her. And that den, you know, he had all kinds of things there. And so many famous people had come through there. To have an audience with them, you know, it's like visiting the Pope or something. And
yeah.
And that was, you know, that was pretty special. Because he's just a regular guy. And, you know, he'd been, the thing I really admire about him most, or respect the most, is what his former players think of.
I was just going to say, they all got the utmost respect for him, and they still live by his rules that aren't game rules,
yeah,
but are life's rules. That
sure.
the pyramid of success, you know,
yeah,
that alone is, you know, is what everybody, all his players go by, you know.
Yeah. You know, Bill Walton would call him almost every day, and other guys would call him. Swin Nader was writing poems for him about him and everything, and it was pretty remarkable because, to me, that's how you ultimately judge a coach, particularly a college coach, is what do his former players think of him? And
yeah,
not all the great ones are that highly respected. I mean, I know IU players who didn't like playing for Bob Knight that well. I know I've talked to Kentucky players who didn't like playing for Adolph Rupp very well. But,
yeah,
you know, man, the UCLA guys, all these years later, you know, really loved Johnny Wooden. And that's not to say there weren't a handful that had conflicts with him or maybe didn't feel like they played enough or whatever. But on the whole, the vast majority really had a lot of respect for him.
Or the story of Bill Russell when he told him they cut his hair, and he said he tried to rebel against that, and Wooden said something like, "Well, it's going to be tough to go on playing without you." In other words, he wasn't going to bend the rules for him.
Yeah.
But I had a Swin Nader, a quick Swin Nader story. I'm not sure how much time you got, Larry, but I was one of my first times in a dressing room. This is kind of embarrassing but kind of funny. I was my first time in a Bucks dressing room. I was still in college, and I had press passes. And before the game, I was with a friend of mine who they were playing the Knicks. He wanted to interview Walt Frazier really bad. So before the game, I lined up an interview for Swin Nader for after the game. Well, we're sitting at the press table, and speaking of fights, a fight broke out between Swin Nader and Lonnie Shelton. And I got my kind of unprofessional, but I got my movie camera with me, and I'm videotaping this fight, and it gets right, you know, 20 feet away from me. So after the game, the Bucks had come from behind to win. We were going to go in the Knicks dressing room first, but then I can't remember the story. We thought we should go in the Bucks dressing room first because the Knicks had blown a big lead. So my friend of mine and I, and we're very rookie-ish, and you're going to know that by the rest of the story, we walk in the dressing room, which we thought was a Bucks dressing room, and it was a Knicks dressing room. And here's Red Holtzman, and he's just screaming at his players, just yelling at them because they'd really choked on the stretch. And all of a sudden he looks at us. We're the only two people that came in. All the press goes to the winning locker room first, I guess is the tradition. And he starts screaming at us, "Go ahead, talk to him, see what they got to say for himself." And my mind is thinking, Swin Nader. I'm thinking about, okay, my question to Swin Nader is going to be, okay, you went to UCLA, where you played behind Jabbar, where you could have gone to any other college in America and been a starter. Do you feel like going to UCLA and playing against Jabbar all days in practice made you a better player? I mean, that's the kind of question I was thinking. So I go up to Bill Bradley, and I have no idea what to say, and I say, "How does it feel to lose a game like this?" Now, what a stupid question. He says, "Bad." And then they go, "Well, do you think you can come back from this?" And he goes, "We're going to have to." And Red Holtzman must be thinking, "Who are these idiots?" So he goes, "Where are you guys from?" And I said, "Well, we're from Oshkosh." He goes, "Oh, Oshkosh. I played against the Oshkosh All-Stars back in the 40s. And he goes, "I used to play at this gym called, it was South Park Gym at junior high." And he was the nicest, you know, it was almost like we kind of loosened up the low, you know, he must have thought, he felt sorry for us because he could have, you know, been, you know, but he was very, very nice after that, you know, how stupid we looked and how, but I mean, Red Holtzman, then he gave us a nice interview. I just left the tape running while we were talking to him. And but it was one of my most embarrassing times. But I always thought to myself later in life when Bill Bradley was thinking about going for president, I thought, you know, I hope he wins because that way I can say interview to president. Even though I got two words out of
a
bad. Yeah. And then I did go and interview Swin Nader, but I mean, that was after the game. But anyway, when you said Swin Nader, it made me think of the Swin Nader story.
Yeah. Yeah. Still with us, Larry?
Yes, I'm still with you. I feel so sports stupid when I'm with you two guys.
Exactly. Yeah.
I feel like an idiot. I mean, it's like, my gosh. Yes, that's, oh, my Lord.
Well, that's how I feel about I feel animal stupid when I'm around you, Larry, because I work for Fish and Wildlife Store, and you still got the animals, you know, with down pat. I work for Fish and Wildlife. I'm here just to get a job. It's a paycheck for me. I got in radio TV to get into sports, and now I ended up getting a job in radio TV, but it's not sports. So, I mean, when you talk about your animals, that's how I kind of feel like, you know, even though I should be knowing more about wildlife than I do, because it's my job, I really don't. So I can turn the table. You know, I feel the same way that you're saying.
Yeah.
Well, when you talk about your wildlife and stuff, but
yeah.
Except for the lake flies, I knew about the lake flies.
You did, yeah. We need photos of that, Dr. Day. What a wonderful show!
No kidding. I don't know what to say other than maybe decaf.
I'm trying to talk slow. I know how people say I speak Chesnees, which is talking really fast, but I've tried to slow down so you could understand me.
Incredible show, gentlemen. Yeah. Incredible.
Mr. Monteith, we want to thank you so very much because we've kept you up here late tonight.
I'm in the studio right now working on the show, so I'm used to being up late, and it's no problem.
Well, we certainly loved having you on the show and you giving us your time. It's been an absolute pleasure, I'll tell you that right now. Absolute pleasure.
Well, I appreciate you asking, and it's a fun conversation.
It was nice talking to you, Mark.
Yes, you too, Mark.
And if the Pacers make the finals, can you get me a ticket?
I don't know.
I'll pay for
we'll
it. Just kidding.
Well,
I'm going to get to a final.
Yeah, well, you might have that opportunity. You know, you've got a place to stay if it's in Indianapolis. So
yeah, I need to get to a finals. It's like my next bucket list there. Anyway.
Okay. Okay. Well, you know what? You should go to Miami. If Miami gets in the finals, you should go because you know those fans aren't quite as. That's a huge city, and it would be a tough ticket. But I bet that would be an easier ticket down there actually than it would be in Indianapolis.
And it would be because they're spoiled by being in four finals in a row.
They're spoiled. And, you know, they're just not as hardcore fans down there.
I know a Yankee fan that when they went to the World Series, he told me he flew down to Florida for the World Series, and it was cheaper for him to get his flight, his hotel, and buy a ticket on the street than it was for him to get a ticket at Yankee Stadium. You know, so and the same thing with when I go to Baltimore, which is, you know, I love Baltimore Stadium, but a lot of times the Red Sox fans and the Yankee fans kind of come down and take over Camden Yards to some extent, and I'm talking to fans, and, you know, I'm understanding they're saying they can come down for a whole weekend and get tickets for Friday, Saturday, Sunday's games, hotel and the gas down there. It's cheaper than a game at Fenway. You know, because Fenway, you know, the face value of Fenway, and especially face value at Yankee Stadium, the new Yankee Stadium is really outrageous. But, you know, so, yeah, I mean, it's probably, you're right, probably about the Miami thing. It's probably my better bet as far as getting a finals ticket. Or maybe San Antonio. And San Antonio, their fans are pretty rabid there in San Antonio as well. So.
Yeah.
And Oklahoma City fans. I went to an Oklahoma City game this year, and that was a great atmosphere.
One arena I have not been to. Yeah,
that was awesome. I'd gone there once before when during Hurricane Katrina, and the New Orleans Jazz played or New Orleans team moved up there. I thought, well, I'm gonna have a game up there while they're playing up there. And then when they got their own team, I thought, well, I still got that little asterisk in my book where I got to see every team play at home. And I thought, well, I've been to this arena, but I still got to go back for the Thunder game. So this year I put a priority on going to the Thunder game, and I also went to the new one in Brooklyn so I could see every NBA arena. And so, but Oklahoma City is the best atmosphere that I've seen in the NBA, but Indiana, I think, is the best stadium. I love your field house, but, you know, it's a great stadium.
Yeah, you know, it's modern, and they made it kind of a retro thing.
Right.
They it's funny, you know, when they were talking about building a new stadium, the original conversation was, we need something really modern and futuristic, you know, because people think of Indiana as backwards, and let's do something really modern. But one guy there, he's no longer there, he was their, like, game operations director, said, why don't we do something to capture the tradition of Indiana basketball? Why don't we do a field house like Boston?
Oh, and they caught that perfectly, yeah.
Yeah, and they did it. And they've got that one lobby entrance. That was came from Donnie Walsh, because the old Madison Square Garden, the one they used before the one they have now, it had, like, everybody walked in the same entrance, and that was something Donnie Walsh really pushed for. So that kind of adds a nice touch where everybody goes in the arena at the same end rather than from different corners, and kind of lends a nice atmosphere to it.
Well, that's one thing baseball's done well. In the old days, baseball had what I call the cookie cutter stadium.
Sure, from the
St. Louis, Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, Atlanta. You know, they all look the same.
And
Cincinnati, you couldn't tell what stadium you're in except for the teams on the field. Then
right.
They all went the dome route. You know, the Astrodome, the Kingdome. Now they've gone the retro route. You know, they've incorporated the city for the most part. I think DC's National Stadium is not good, but the Orioles is with a brick wall, and the Pittsburgh with a bridge, and San Francisco, and you know, the new stadiums that they've got today in baseball, they've gone their own way instead of you know being a retrofit like they used to do, and I think it's made baseball stadiums that much better to visit, and they're all got their own unique experiences. So it's anyway.
Yeah,
it's all good, gentlemen. Thank you very much.
Okay, Larry. Thanks, Brad.
Thanks, Larry.
And Ronnie Siegel will be with us next week, session drummer for Anybody and Everybody in Rock and Roll. It's going to be a great hour. As well as our 90 minutes we had tonight. Absolutely wonderful. absolutely. You've been listening to Wild World on Blog Talk Radio. Good night, everybody.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thanks for listening this week to Larry Batson's Wild World. sure to join us again next week at 10 p.m. for more of the latest outdoor and wildlife news and information, along with great tales from your host, world-renowned wildlife expert, Mr. Larry Batson. Tune in again next week for another exciting edition of Larry Batson's Wild World. Larry Batson's Wild World is a Batson Wildlife Educational Services production in association with Blog Talk Radio.